Blue Dot Episode 21, the award-winning Dawn spacecraft.
This is Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem.
And I'm Matt Schiltz.
And today, Matt, we're talking about something right out of science fiction, something from Star Trek.
Literally out of science fiction.
It literally, you know, was part of the original Star Trek series, Ion Propulsion. Spock, what do you see?
Configuration unidentified, ion propulsion, high velocity, though of a unique technology.
But now it's science fact.
But now it's science fact. We're talking about the Dawn spacecraft. It wasn't the first to use ion propulsion. The Deep Space One was the demonstration of the technology back in the 90s. But this spacecraft has done some amazing things. It's been out visiting two of the largest of what we used to call the asteroids. They're actually really dwarf planets or, you know, planetoids out there. They're worlds, Vesta and Ceres. And Ceres is big enough that it's round. It looks like a planet out there. And they're very interesting worlds. They have dramatic topography. And
of course, we saw those bright white spots on Ceres.
Strange that were white all over spots the internet. Was all over the internet. People wondering, what is that? What could be causing that? And still, you know, a bit of a scientific mystery. But
first, we're going to go back in time to last summer and get some background on Ceres and the Dawn spacecraft. This is back from when Blue Dot was the much shorter Blue Dot report. Dawn was orbiting Ceres and had just sent back some startling images to Earth. That was almost exactly 1 year ago. Then we're going to come back and hear from Tim Wise. So step with us into the time machine where we're going to hear Dave's conversation with Mark Raymond, the chief engineer on Dawn.
This is the Blue Dot Report, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. NASA's Dawn spacecraft, with its remarkable ion propulsion drive, is in orbit over the largest object in the asteroid belt, the dwarf planet Ceres. The world has turned out to be far more interesting than the lump of rock it was once previously thought to be, and joining us to talk about the mission and Ceres is Dr. Mark Raymond, the spacecraft's chief engineer and mission director at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Let's start with Dawn. How is the spacecraft doing, and where exactly is it with relationship to Ceres?
Hi, Dave. Well, Dawn is doing very well. It's orbiting Ceres at an altitude of 2,700 miles, and we just wrapped up a very successful science campaign. We have four phases in our exploration of Ceres, and we've now completed two of them. We had a glitch shortly after we started maneuvering to our next orbit, but it won't have any long-term consequences. The nice thing about being in orbit, as opposed to flying by for a brief visit, and having a uniquely capable ion propulsion system is that we have a very flexible mission plan. And so we will get on our way soon to the next science orbit and undertake more mapping.
Tell us about Ceres. It's best classified as a dwarf planet. What do we know about this world so far?
Yeah, well, you're right. It is a dwarf planet. In fact, it's the largest object between the Sun and Pluto that a spacecraft had not previously visited before the Dawn mission. And of the millions and millions of objects in the main asteroid belt, Ceres has about a third of the total mass. So it's a huge place. It's got 38% of the area of the continental United States. And we know it's a world, a small planet of rock and ice, and we're there to tease out its secrets and learn what it can tell us about the solar system and the nature of such mysterious bodies.
Speaking of mysterious, tell us about the bright spots that you've spotted on Ceres. What might those be?
Yeah, well, one of the things that people ask about them is, could they be evidence of an alien city? And, you know, I always think that's ridiculous. We don't know enough about Ceres to know whether aliens there would live in cities or states or rural communities or what. But whatever they are, they're very reflective. They're just like beacons shining out into space. And they might be ice on the surface, or they might be salts, for example, left over when ice on the surface had sublimated, that is, like melted or evaporated, gone into space and left behind the material that was dissolved in it. We don't know what these brilliant lights are, but we're looking forward to getting down closer and getting even more data on them.
Real quick, what's up next for Dawn? When will it be getting closer, and when are we can expect to see more images?
Well, soon we will use our ion propulsion system to maneuver to an orbit of 900 miles altitude, so we'll get pictures three times better than what we have now. And we will get there in August, spend 2 months there, and then by the end of the calendar year, we will have maneuvered down to an orbit of only about 230 miles above the surface, closer than the space station is to Earth, and we'll get pictures almost 12 times better than we have now.
Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Mark Raymond, chief engineer for NASA's Dawn spacecraft. The report is a production of NSPR. Visit us at mynspr.org. We get support from the Gateway Science Museum. Check them out at csuchico.edu/gateway. Our engineer is Matt Schultz. I'm Dave Schlom, reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.
Wow, Dawn still holds up a year later.
The other thing that's cool about this is this spacecraft and this mission won an extremely prestigious award just recently, the Collier Trophy.
Does that mean they get a gift certificate to Collier Hardware in Chico?
No, this is even better than that. The Collier Trophy is like the best picture Oscar for the aerospace community. And, you know, some of the great names in the history of aviation, Orville Wright, Neil Armstrong, the first astronauts, you know, NASA's early days, the Voyager spacecraft won the Collier Trophy. The Mars Laboratory, Mars Science Laboratory, Curiosity was a recent winner. A lot of times they're military aircraft or prototype aircraft. So it's a big deal to win this. And so to be selected for that out of all the other possibilities, that was quite an honor. The Collier Trophy, it's kept at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, and it's presented by the National Aeronautics Association. And this year, the recipient was the Dawn spacecraft team and the Dawn spacecraft itself. So we're going to be talking about it with Timothy Wise. He's the deputy mission director for the Dawn mission that's been out exploring the asteroid belt and the two largest bodies out there. We are talking with Tim Wise. He's the deputy mission director for Dawn. When Dawn was launched, tell us about how long the mission was designed to last. When was the launch date?
Dawn launched in September of 2007 with an eight-year mission design that took it until about June of this year, 2016.
Can you give us a sense of the size of the spacecraft?
Well, at the time of its launch, it was the largest spacecraft launched by NASA, and the solar arrays would stretch from home plate to the pitcher's mound on a professional baseball field. So it's about 20 meters from tip to tip of the solar arrays.
Give us a sense of the suite of instruments aboard.
There are three scientific instruments. The first is a framing camera, which takes visible pictures of the surface, and then a visible and infrared mapping spectrometer, which uses the reflection of light off of the surface to determine the mineral makeup, and then a gamma ray and neutron detector, which uses gamma rays and neutrons that are reflected or emitted off of the surface to determine the mineral makeup to a slightly deeper depth than just looking at the surface. It also uses the radios to help determine the gravity field of the body itself.
Now, Dawn was designed to go out into the asteroid belt and study the two largest bodies out there, Vesta and Ceres, right?
Yes.
And why were they selected as targets? What was the reason for that?
Well, I wasn't directly involved in that aspect of the mission, but those two bodies are surviving remnants of the epoch of planetary formation. They're entirely unlike typical asteroids, and by studying them, it gives us more insight into those bodies and those bodies that actually turned into full-size planets. And so it helps us understand how the planets of the solar system formed.
Can you give us a sense of how large those two bodies are, like, say, compared to the Moon?
Both of them are significantly smaller than the Moon. The Vesta, if you laid it on a map of California, it would fit between Los Angeles and San Francisco.
What are some of the scientific highlights from the Vesta encounter?
I think one of the really interesting things was that the investigation at Vesta showed that it looks more like a mini planet than an asteroid. It has the body is differentiated with a core, a mantle, and a crust, and that was something that we were able to confirm. It was hypothesized before Dawn was able to get there, and then the Dawn data actually confirmed that.
And then how about Ceres?
I think the biggest point of interest has been the bright regions that everybody has seen in the pictures that have come back, which turned out to be salt deposits that were formed when frozen briny water at the surface sublimated and left the mineral deposit behind, which ends up being much more reflective than the rest of the surface, which is why it shows up so bright in the images.
So those are the mysterious bright markings on Ceres that we heard so much about as it was heading in there.
Yes.
Let's talk about the unique propulsion system, because that's one of the most amazing things about this spacecraft, is it uses ion propulsion. Explain to us how that works.
So to compare ion propulsion with a chemical rocket uses a chemical reaction to expand gases and eject them out of the rocket nozzle, where ion propulsion uses xenon gas and electricity from the solar arrays to turn the xenon gas into ions and then accelerate the ions at extremely high velocity out of the thruster, which is about 10 times more efficient than a chemical engine, but at very reduced thrust. In fact, the amount of thrust from the thruster is equivalent to about the weight of a piece of paper in your hand.
So what you're doing is you're trading, it's just a really slow acceleration process, right?
Yes, we like to call it, you know, 0 to 60 in 4 days.
And how fast is the spacecraft going, you know, after a long period of acceleration?
Dawn has imparted more velocity change using its own propulsion system than any other spacecraft. In fact, it's accelerated the spacecraft by more than 11 kilometers per second, which is about as much as the entire launch vehicle launching the spacecraft into orbit.
It just does that over a long period of time.
Yes, it's taken over 5 years of continuous operation of the thruster to achieve that acceleration.
Why is ion propulsion particularly efficient? What was it chosen for this mission?
Well, I think the efficiency comes down to you're getting some of the energy going into the acceleration comes from electricity. So you don't have to carry as much fuel as you would if you had a chemical rocket, where all the energy is stored in the fuel itself. And so that enables you to have this great maneuverability in terms of being able to change the orbit over time at a much lower mass. In fact, you wouldn't be able to do the mission that Dawn has done, going from one body to another, using chemical rocket engines. They'd just be too heavy.
You're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR, and we are talking to Tim Wise, Deputy Mission Director for the Dawn spacecraft. Now, recently, you guys got quite an honor. You won the Collier Award. Could you tell us a little bit about what is the Collier Award?
Yes. And it's truly an honor to be, you know, included in such a prestigious award. It is the most prestigious award in the U.S. for aviation or space. And the quotation that came with the award for Dawn, the Collier Award is the most prestigious award in the U.S. for aviation or space. It is awarded for the most significant accomplishment, and Dawn received it for the extraordinary achievements of orbiting and exploring protoplanet Vesta and dwarf planet Ceres and advancing the nation's technological capabilities and pioneering new frontiers in space travel.
And, you know, just looking at the history of the Collier Award, I mean, one of the first winners was Orville Wright.
Yes, and it's truly an honor to be included in, you know, Orville Wright, the Mars Curiosity landing team, and the Apollo 11 astronauts. I mean, it's amazing to be included on that list of truly great accomplishments.
And did you get to go back for the award ceremony?
Yes, I did. There was a very nice ceremony where they presented the trophy to Mark Raymond, our mission director, as well as the director of the lab and the NASA deputy administrator.
Now, the trophy itself is pretty large, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's 7 feet tall, and it has all of a plaque for each of the recipients in the past, and it's kept at the National Air and Space Museum.
So Dawn's on there with Neil Armstrong and Orville Wright, and oh, that's just amazing. That must have been quite a thrill.
Absolutely. I keep having to pinch myself, thinking, this is just my job, and end up being included in such great achievements.
And where was the ceremony?
The ceremony was in Washington, D.C.
Is that at the Smithsonian or?
No, it was at the Ritz-Carlton in Pentagon City.
Sounds pretty nice. And the trophy itself, though, is at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum?
Yes, it's kept there, and one time a year they move it out to wherever the award ceremony is being held.
And do you guys get, like, miniature versions of the trophy to take home?
There were three miniature versions. One went to NASA headquarters, one went to JPL headquarters, and one went to the project.
Wow, that's pretty exciting. You're listening to Blue Dot. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, more with Tim Wise on the award-winning Dawn spacecraft. And we're back talking with Tim Wise. He's Deputy Mission Director for the Dawn spacecraft at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Let's get back to talking about the ion propulsion system, because it's one of the most unique things about Dawn. It's not the first spacecraft, though, to use it, is it?
No, Deep Space One was a technology demonstration in the late 90s, which validated the technology for interplanetary travel.
And do you think that ion propulsion is going to be used a lot in future missions?
Oh, absolutely. It's being proposed on several new missions coming up. It's also part of the asteroid redirect mission. They're planning on using that, as well as it's being evaluated for human spaceflight to Mars.
Where is Dawn right now?
Dawn is currently orbiting the dwarf planet Ceres.
And just to give us a sense, how far away is that?
Well, it's currently almost, the distance from the spacecraft or Ceres to the sun is about three times the distance from the Earth to the sun. And the distance, it takes about 25 minutes for a radio signal to get from Earth to the spacecraft.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved with this mission?
Actually, it was a suggestion from my team lead at the time to go apply for this new job on the small mission that no one really knew about. And that was back in 2004. And I started as the spacecraft engineering team lead and have been with it ever since.
And so for like a typical day for you working on Dawn, what kinds of things do you do?
So a typical day for me consists of checking on the status of the spacecraft and any future activity planning development as we're operating the spacecraft. We have to plan ahead. We usually plan about 3 weeks in advance. And so we have to make sure that process is going smoothly, as well as making sure the spacecraft is doing what we asked it to do for the last 3 weeks.
Have there been any moments like during the mission where there's been any kind of particular problems that have popped up that we've had to fix?
Well, in fact, the spacecraft uses these devices called reaction wheels, which are used to control the direction that the spacecraft is pointing. And on the way to Vesta, one of those wheels failed. And it requires three wheels to maintain three-axis control. So we decided that we need to save the wheels for Vesta encounter, and we reprogrammed the flight software to use our reaction control system to control the attitude, and then turned the wheels back on for Vesta and worked successfully. And then as we were departing Vesta, a second wheel failed. And at that point, we had to completely reprogram the flight software to only use two wheels and the jets for the other axis. And that being able to overcome those, you know, losing those two wheels and still meet our full mission success criteria is one of the hugest accomplishments that I've been a part of.
Wow. Are there any other really memorable moments that stand out for you on the Dawn mission?
I think the biggest moment is really, for me, a series of moments as we approached Vesta. Each week or so, we would take an optical navigation image of Vesta, and the first ones were a couple of pixels, and then a couple weeks later, it was 10 pixels, and then, you know, a month later, it was 100 pixels, and it just kept growing bigger and bigger, and you know, went from a spot to this fully resolved image of Vesta to more detail than the Hubble Space Telescope provided, and all of the features started showing up, and just that progression from the blurry images of Hubble to a high-resolution image of Vesta was just amazing. And then we repeated it when we went to Ceres.
And how much longer is the mission designed to last?
Our prime mission is actually scheduled to end at the end of this week. However, the spacecraft has quite a bit of resources left, and we're still evaluating what the best way to use those resources would be.
What's your favorite thing about your job?
My favorite aspect of working on Dawn is the, you know, incredible new discoveries that the project makes day in and day out. You know, as a result of the team environment of every person contributing their part of the project and, you know, returning such, you know, fabulous science data for the scientists to analyze and eventually rewrite the textbooks.
Why do you personally think that exploring space in general is important and the asteroids, you know, that, because really that's kind of starting to turn into a region of exploration in the solar system that's drawing more and more attention?
I think it's important to explore space for a couple of reasons. Some of the big ones are to maintain our technological edge. You know, a lot of the NASA work is developing new technologies. A lot of those ripple down into, you know, the commercial sector and to the general public. In fact, I was just watching a Forensics Files TV program, and they were using techniques developed when the Hubble Space Telescope mirror was flawed. They had to come up with software to process the images. Well, they used that same software to help resolve, you know, poor images of a security footage.
You're speaking right now, you know, on behalf of a pretty big team. How many scientists and engineers are directly involved with Dawn?
At JPL, there's about 40 engineers, and a few of those are actually scientists. There's a much broader science community that processes the data.
What would you like us to understand about this type of robotic spacecraft exploration that people may not? What are some of the misconceptions people have? I mean, like, you know, when you're at Thanksgiving dinner and you're telling Aunt Gladys, you know, what you do, what kind of things do they say that you, well, that's not quite how it works.
Yeah, I think one of the things I always kind of relate to is, you know, if you're driving your car, you can hear a funny noise and you can pull over and look at it and try to fix it. On the spacecraft, we have a very limited set of data coming back, so you don't necessarily hear or get, you know, a temperature indication. You don't really know exactly what's going on all over the spacecraft. So there's a lot of investigation to interpret the data you have to figure out what's really going on. And so a lot of it is engineering judgment. It's not always cut and dried.
All right, Tim, thank you.
All right, thank you.
You're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR, and we've been talking to Tim Wise. He's the Deputy Mission Director for the award-winning Dawn spacecraft. So, Matt, science fiction from the 60s, something from Star Trek that sounded so futuristic. Ion propulsion is a real thing, and it's probably a real future way for tooling around the solar system in a really efficient way without using giant rockets.
Yeah, well, and the writers for Star Trek, they were just picking out stuff that sounded cool, right? They were just picking out stuff that sounded believable.
Yeah, but sometimes, you know, it's those little bits of science fact that filter their way into science fiction that, you know, one of the reasons that I like Star Trek is, you know, that they say things that sound plausible, even though sometimes they're not. And that's what the charm of it is, I think. But, yeah, I remember when I first saw that, ion propulsion, that'll never happen. That'll be like warp drive.
Right.
And now it's something that's real.
It is real, and it is wildly efficient, and it's really cool to kind of hear about how it slowly builds. But when you're talking massive distances and massive long amounts of time, you've got time to build up that speed.
Yeah, you don't have to get to 0 to 60 in 6 seconds. You can take several days to do that, but you're just continually slowly accelerating till eventually you're going thousands of miles per hour. Basically, what you're doing is you're taking atoms and you're stripping away the particles to make ions, charged particles. And then those basically are ejected out the back end of the spacecraft engine. The ions make an electrical field, and that creates propulsion. And so, you know, Newton's third law, for every action, equal and opposite reaction, the ions go out, the spacecraft goes forward.
And the change in acceleration is the weight of a piece of paper,
yeah.
He said.
Yeah, and it's very small, but...
But when there's no friction.
There's no friction, and you've got lots of time to let this just build up. So it's a fascinating way of doing it. Probably not the way you'd want to get humans. I don't know. Maybe at this point it might not be the most efficient way. So, for example, if you wanted to send a mission to Mars with humans, you want to get them there as fast as possible. So perhaps in the future it might be like once you get going to a certain speed, you might use ion propulsion to continue your acceleration and augment that.
What a time to be alive.
Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out our podcasts at mynspr.org. Follow us on Twitter at NSPRNews and me at Dave Shlohm. I am reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.